y'all get out to see the cherry trees? We've gone through our first wave. I think it's now only the second wave flowering
Hi.
trees and the stragglers.
Me
I've been
and so busy. I haven't even barely noticed. I was just noticing today. Oh, look, there's flowers on trees. That's nice.
Oh, and then poof.
Me and my partner actually, we with the first warm day, we were like, let's go for a walk on the seawall.
Yeah.
And that walk took us by David Lamb Park downtown, and we just accidentally ran into Cherry Fest. So,
Yeah.
like, David Lamb Park has like a huge outdoor festival. They put lights in all the cherry trees. There's food trucks, and like it was really fun. I didn't know what was
Yeah.
happening, and we just like accidentally came across it. So that was really fun. I think that's more fun than my other tradition around this time of year, which is to look up the Instagram account called Cherry Blossom Madness, which is somebody who lives in one of the most popular areas to get your photo taken in front of a cherry tree. And they hate every person that comes into their neighborhood to take photos. And like their Instagram feed is a documentation of everyone who's very inconsiderate, like standing in the middle of the road, like getting their photos taken and like walking across her lawn and like ignoring her no trespassing signs. And
Deal
like,
with it.
it's
It's
like,
like 1 week.
I know it's cherry blossoms. It's like, ah, come on. But I don't know. There's something about this, like, this like curmudgeonly persona of like these damn kids and their cherry trees.
Oh man. Well, I gotta tell you, Jeff, now that you live downtown, but like I used to hunt all around the city for like the best, like through all those residential neighborhoods and like where's the best spot? Like where are the best tree clusters? And the conclusion that I came to is that David Lamb Park is the best
I
in
mean,
terms of just like access and in density and enjoyability. Some of the spots downtown are the best in the city.
from what I've seen, they look pretty great. Yeah. And like no one's mad at you if you stop and take a photo in front of them because it's
Yeah.
the park. All right. Speaking of people being mad at you, that's all I got. There's no cherry blossoms in this book.
No.
No. I mean, yeah, today's pick, I'll totally admit, is inspired a little bit by like mood caused by current events. So we're gonna like dive into a story about reaping re ultimate revenge on your enemies.
Very
And
uplifting.
how that maybe you're ultimately still not actually going to feel any better about yourself afterwards.
I
What is
think,
the book? Yeah, so we're talking about Craven's Last Hunt, which is a six issue story arc that went across all three monthly Spider-Man titles. So maybe my quick comic nerd moment here is just because I want to educate you guys on superhero comics. When you have a character like Spider-Man, it's so popular, you create additional spin-off titles. So you start with Amazing Spider-Man, and then you get Spectacular Spider-Man, and then you get Web of Spider-Man. And since you realize not everyone's reading all three of those titles, you take one story and you chop it up and you put one chapter in each of those different monthly titles. So now someone has to buy three magazines this week, if they want to, or this month, if they want to get the first three chapters. They can't just read Amazing Spider-Man to get the story.
Sounds frustrating.
So you guys have the benefit of it being collected in one trade paperback, but it was originally presented across three different magazines.
I couldn't even tell in the collected edition that they was supposed to be different magazines. I probably wasn't paying attention.
Well, I mean, to be fair, this was actually done in a better way than a lot of these crossovers were done later. So this has the same creative team across all of the different magazines. So each, whether it's Amazing or Spectacular or Web of Spider-Man, it has the same writer, the same penciler, the same inker in subsequent 1990s crossovers, they would just have the existing creative team do one chapter. So if you were reading, say, like the Spider-Man Clone Saga, each chapter would have like a different artist and a different writer. And so there'd be these huge tonal shifts as the story progressed. So I think this is actually the superior way to do your crossover, which is you hire some people to do a six chapter arc, and then you spread it out after the fact once the work has been already drawn.
I agree. Like what you've just described sounds like an absolute mess.
Oh yeah, no, like when you're saying that, I'm comparing it to the Infinity Gauntlet saga, which was every single Marvel comic for however many months. Like it's all about Thanos and the Infinity Gems, and that's it. That's the and if you want to know the whole story, you got to buy every single comic that Marvel is publishing.
And some of them will be drawn by artists you like, and some of them will be drawn by artists you hate.
And
And
some of them are relevant to the plot, and a lot of them are not. Yeah,
Anyway,
nice.
glad it's not that. We can do a whole episode just on Marvel continuity, but instead, let's start with our character building question. So I thought for my character building question, I would say, as we are all kind of, entering our middle age, let's say, what are some healthy ways of dealing with getting older, as that this story is about someone dealing with the getting older in an unhealthy way?
That's not an easy question to answer.
I'll lead us off. So, my name's Jeff Ellis, and I think when I turned 30, I read a listicle that was like things you should start now that you'll be glad you did, like when you're 40. Like things to start doing in your 30s, you'll be glad you did in your 40s. And one of the things was yoga. And I actually really am glad that I started that. And I think I'm a lot less achy and creaky now because I try to regularly stretch my body out. And yeah, that was a good move, I think, on past Jeff's part.
Okay, interesting. I'm a big fan of yoga. My name is Jam, and I think I'm an elder millennial, so I'm 40 now. And I think for me, what has helped the most with aging is actually acceptance. I think when I started to see signs of aging, it was almost a relief. Because I think when I was younger, everyone always told me, it's like, oh, you got to do these things when you're young in your body, because your body's going to like immediately fall apart. And it's like, oh, shit, okay. So I felt like I was under a lot of pressure to just like go all the time and do things that were at the limits of my physical capabilities. And now that I'm a little older, I feel like I can just like chill and just be like grateful for the things that I can still do. Some of the things that helped me, I got into weightlifting a couple years ago, and that's been, I think, tremendously valuable. I wish I started lifting weights earlier. I did learn how to work out earlier, but it just wasn't the right mix of circumstances for me to get truly into powerlifting, but I'd been interested for a long time, and I think it really helps me feel able to cope with, yeah, life's challenges, life's physical challenges, and I'm hoping it will help me going forward.
I'm JD, and I think the best advice I can think of for getting older is to kill your nostalgia. You don't, the past is another country and you don't live there anymore.
No.
I'm being harsh. This is like the equivalent of the writer's advice, kill your darlings. Like, no, you don't have to kill all your characters, but you have to be willing to take that step. Like, you don't have to hang on to things from the past, regrets or things you didn't accomplish or anything like that, because like you still got a whole life ahead of you. Worry about where you are right now.
Okay, I like it. You brought that back around for me. But I will be clinging to my 90s manga with my cold dead hand,
Sure. I mean, I'm not saying you can't like anything that you liked in the past. Like, if we want to do a whole second podcast about Babylon 5, I'm here for
Oh no, we might.
it. But I'm also not gonna go around pushing this show from the 90s on other people, because yeah, I get there's better stuff now.
Yeah,
Hey.
I think that's valid. That's valid.
All right. In defense of Babylon 5, John, I will tell you, I convinced my friend Kate to watch Babylon 5, and she got so into it. So, like, it's a good show. You get the right person, it can hold. I mean, like, it's got problems, but like for the time it was made, for what the limitations were, I think like they did a pretty good job. Like,
Yes, I'm on board with that. I mean, I like that show, but this is not the Babylon 5 podcast.
anyway, sorry. Okay.
So before we go any farther, I think this book might need some content warning for the episode.
Yes, 100%. This is one of the first grimdark stories of the 1980s. So there is cannibalism, there's suicide, there's being buried alive. There's a lot of upsetting content because it's the 1980s and we're making a superhero book.
Comics
So
aren't for kids anymore.
yeah, comics aren't for kids anymore. I don't know if you guys heard that, but
Bang, pow.
if you're not interested in talking about cannibalistic serial killers and suicide, maybe this isn't the episode for you. So, speaking of not killing your nostalgia, this was 100% a nostalgia pick for me. I've been kind of interested in doing some more superhero stuff, and I like wanted to do a Spider-Man story. And I would say in up until even today, Kraven's Last Hunt is often cited as one of the greatest Spider-Man stories ever told. I pulled it out of my back issue bin because I still had the single issues, and I reread it. And I thought, you know, there's something here. There's something here to talk about. And so I put this forward as a trade waiter with a little bit of trepidation, knowing it was full of content warnings. And the other reason I wanted to talk about this is it has the writing of J.M. DeMatteis. So J.M. DeMatteis grew up in Brooklyn. He studied at the School of Visual Art. He eventually found himself writing comics instead of drawing comics. He found writing more satisfying. He started out writing Captain America and working with Mike Zeck, who also is the penciler working with him on this series. He eventually got on to writing Spider-Man, and he did this Kraven's Last Hunt arc, which kind of made his career. He became the regular writer on the Spectacular Spider-Man, and that particular iteration of Spider-Man was a fairly dark and twisted iteration of the character, often centered around mentally unwell characters getting into their trauma and backstory. He became so successful, he became the mainstay writer for Amazing Spider-Man. And so when I started reading the character, he was the head writer, and the incidents from this story arc hung heavy over Peter Parker and Spider-Man. So this sort of was like a touchstone in the continuity when I was introduced to the character. And he actually did revisit the Vermin and give him actually a little bit of a, I don't know, a redemption arc of some sorts. It's very complicated because it's, we can get into talk about that character later. But then also, the other thing that really compelled me was Mike Zeck. I think he's just a top-notch penciler. I really loved his work in this series. DeMatteis actually said that he felt that Mike Zeck's storytelling visually freed him up to focus on the internal monologue and not worry so much about the visual storytelling aspect. He kind of trusted Mike to just tell the story visually, and then he did all the internal thoughts, was what he focused on. And his writing is marked by this sort of postmodern beat poet like stream of consciousness. That's sort of something that's a signature of DeMatteis's work, at least on the Spider-Man series. And then the other thing I really liked about the story is it has the black costume. It is not the alien life form black costume that became Venom, but after that was revealed, Spider-Man got a black cloth version that he would wear. And when you Spider-Man's having a bad time, he's wearing his black costume.
So yeah, I had a question about that. Yeah, like why? So it's just the Spider-Man costume but black because he's emo. Is that it?
He basically, I think that's the easiest
Okay.
way to describe it. He found a costume on an alien world that was this black and white design, and it was revealed to be an alien, and they got rid of it. He thought he killed it, and for some reason he decided to stitch a cloth version of the same design and start wearing it. I can't really rationalize that very well, but
I think the rationalization is that it looks cool.
I mean, sorry, I was gonna say the reason I don't challenge it is I think it looks really cool. It's actually, in some ways, I like that costume more than the red and blue. And then just a quick little extra fun note is the costume, the idea of Spider-Man having a new costume was actually proposed by a fan. He wrote a pitch to Marvel about Spider-Man finding an alien costume and that it would be this sort of black minimalist design. And they went and used it and they didn't actually talk to this guy about it. And so then when he commented on it, they wrote him a check for $220.
Wow, we. I mean,
And
it's unusual to get that kind of acknowledgement, actually.
yeah.
Yeah, I think this is why Marvel and DC writers will no longer listen to your pitches because it creates this uncertain copyright issue. So they're like told by Marvel and DC, don't listen to fan pitches. Like, don't even read them, don't even accept them. Like, just shut it down before you hear it because you don't want to be like this exact scenario.
Yeah, so I'm just going to shout out Randy Schuler. Randy Schuler was the original inception of this new costume. Rick Leonardi did the initial design, and Mike Zeck perfected it. And then one final fun note before we talk about the story. The original costume was supposed to be black and red, and I'm going to turn to John, our color nerd. Why do you think they got rid of the red?
I don't know, because it looks spooky.
Well, think about print technology in the 1980s.
Oh, because it would have like weird shapes on the black part if you
Yeah,
had red parts.
they would have a rich black overlap.
Yeah, okay, that makes a lot of sense.
Looked weird, so they just gave up on putting a color on the spider and just went black and white.
Yeah.
Well, I think it worked.
Yeah, I think it's better. I think the red
Yeah.
wouldn't have worked as well.
Okay,
Anyway.
so that was one of my main questions, like. Because it was never explained. So I'm like, oh, it's Spider-Man, but black. Why?
I did also have that question because I knew about the whole thing with the Venom costume, but I didn't know where we were in the timeline. Like, is this the Venom costume? But no, it seems to be just cloth.
No, it's just the cloth suit.
Okay, but
And
after there has been a Venom costume.
yes. Or well, no, this is before Venom showed up.
But it's the symbiote existed.
Yes, the symbiote does
Yeah.
exist. So they established the alien costume. But now it's a fabric costume he's wearing. At this point in the continuity, basically Spider-Man would get up in the morning and be like, "Am I having a good day or a bad day?" And then he would just like put on the costume that fit his mood.
So it's
I
like
respect that.
what happened in the movies then is you had like the in the first three movies you had the scene where Peter Parker would like put the emo hair on the one side and just like
Yeah.
strut very very sadly. It's like that was what represented the black costume in the movie continuity, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, I think that actually is more accurate than they were intending.
Oh, I think that was fully intentional.
But yeah, so I don't know. I have some notes just on like the character of Kraven, the character of Vermin and Ned Leeds. Thought I would just stop right now and just sort of say where how do what did you guys think of this crazy work I had you read?
I have like my second question, which
Okay.
I had throughout the work, which is okay, so Kraven had his parents in Russia, and throughout the work he's trying to get revenge on Spider-Man for death of his parents. So my question is like, did Spider-Man literally kill this guy's parents? Did Spider-Man literally cause them to get excommunicated from Russia? Like that was a little unclear for me.
That's okay. That's a really good question. So the answer is no. Basically, Kraven showed up in Amazing Spider-Man number 15, and he was this big game hunter who was kind of looking for his next challenge, and he is stepbrother was the Chameleon, who's another Spider-Man villain. And the Chameleon was like, what better prey than this guy with spider powers? And so then Kraven became obsessed with besting Spider-Man and capturing him. And this was going to be his ultimate hunt. So Spider-Man became his sort of fixation. So, like, all this stuff about his parents being excommunicated. I mean, I think that's more feeding into his depression and the issues he's not dealing with.
Okay.
And so Spider-Man is the focus of all of this. Basically, because he won't go to therapy, Spider-Man has to suffer.
Yeah,
Yeah. So,
that was
okay.
how I interpreted it. That's like
Okay.
I like that about the character, that he's blaming Spider-Man for things that he has nothing to do with, because like nothing can be Kraven's fault. Everything has to be other people's fault.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you for confirming that, because that is also the read that I got, but it was the way it was written was not super clear to me.
Yeah, and that is a common thing in Spider-Man stories where like everybody has this like soap opera connection with each other.
Yeah. So the whole thing about him coming from aristocrats and his family kind of being destroyed by the rise of communism in Russia, that was all created by Dematis basically in this work, trying to give more depth to the character who, you know, if you go back to the original appearance, was just kind of this like,
Cartoon character.
or yeah, this sort of he's just like, he's a hunter and he's like a white guy, but he dresses in this like Africanized wardrobe and it's very like fetishistic. You know, he's this crazy jungle man who fights with a spear and a net. And so I don't know. I think like one of the things I found interesting about this work was that it sort of took this like ridiculous character and sort of gave it, I don't know, kind of some pathos. I actually really, maybe I'm at the right age, but like reading some of this stuff, like the sense that he's going through this essentially a midlife crisis and just doing all this insane stuff because he can't go to therapy and like deal with his problems. I was like, oh man, I kind of get this, except I went to therapy, but like, yeah.
It's rough. They didn't have therapy in the 80s. So, all right. Well, I think overall, I thought this was an interesting work. I, from the perspective of someone who has not read a lot of superhero comics, I liked that it felt very contained. You know, it's like you had Spider-Man. I know who Spider-Man is. And then you have Kraven. And it's like, I knew Kraven was this like hunter dude. And it seems like I didn't need to know much more than that because apparently a lot of this backstory was from this. And so the fact that it was contained in here, I'm like, cool. The story was very focused on the two of them. And then you had the vermin, which also I didn't know a lot of backstory about, but it didn't really matter. So from my perspective, I liked that it was a tight arc. I liked that it was very contained. I thought it went to some interesting emotional places. And the art was really good. So yeah, it was cool.
Yeah, like I think the first chapter, the first like issue, I guess, like really sold me on this. Like I read that and was like, oh, this is actually really good. I don't feel like I had as much enthusiasm for the rest of the story. It went to some weird places. But the setup was like, I can't believe people were making this in like 1980, whatever.
1987, so it was a year after Watchmen.
Okay. I did feel like one of the things I really like about it is the paneling, like the panel to panel transitions, the choice of moment was like really, really good. Like the drawing style is competent. It's not the kind of thing I normally would gravitate to. It seems pretty standard comic book 1980s like techniques or style, but the paneling was like as good as Watchmen. Like that really speaks well to this artist to be able to tell the story the way that it's told, like with the like jumping back and forth between scenes and like, yeah, like I feel like this is probably way better paneling than you were getting like 10 years earlier in superheroes.
Yeah. I thought the poses were really good. So I thought the poses and anatomy were really interesting. Something that I noticed that I think carried on through subsequent Spider-Man comics, but it was the first time I really noticed it, was the way that Spider-Man is always crawling on walls. So it's like there's the scene where he finally gets to Kraven's mansion and he's like following him. But he's a little suspicious. And so he's always like up on the wall or like on the ceiling and like crawling through the door, like from the top underneath. I thought that was really funny. I thought also that this comic had a really strong and interesting use of light and shadow in the inking style. So I just took a course on light and shadow, so I'm especially tuned into this, but it jumped out at me as something like there were some really, really strong lighting choices. And those are emphasized by this era's like super black inking style. The shadow is often pushed right into spot black. And so something about this era of comics are these huge areas of spot black in the inks. But I think the way that that was done in this comic is very evocative.
Yeah, like if you look in the back of the trade, they've got some examples of the pencils from these pages, and they're works of art. Like I like them better as just pencils than with the inks and colors, actually.
Yeah, the pencils were so tight.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I found rereading this, I became a bigger fan of Mike Zeck at the end. But I also want to shout out Bob McLeod, who is the inker, and Rick Parker, who did the lettering. Because
Cool. Yeah, the lettering really stood out too.
you guys also contribute.
This would be hand lettering, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and there's like multiple different fonts for hand lettering. So it's interesting. So at the beginning, so the first chapter had three different narrators going on simultaneously, which is a really tricky thing to do in written voice. So it was a little frustrating because I've said before that for me, like the narration in superhero comics is something that I find a little annoying. It's not the way that I prefer to read a comic, but in this case, because each voice was very distinct and it was layering on a different perspective on the same situation, the same point in time, like I thought it was a really interesting way to do it.
Yeah, like I think that I'm right with you with the first chapter. I do feel like the gap between the visual story and the narration got to me after a while. Like this feels like the prototypical example of that Scott McCloud thing where he's talking about this is an Understanding Comics where he's talking about the writer trying to write the best story they can write and the artist trying to do the best art they can do, and they kind of like move far apart from each other, and so they can't hold hands in the middle anymore. Like that feels like that's what this book is. Like the writing is really good and the art is really good, but only sometimes do they connect fully.
That makes sense. Yeah, I agree with that.
I definitely think there was a few moments where like there was, say, like a sentence, and then they would break it up over like a multi-panel sequence, and just the way that maybe it was placed, like you sort of would read a word and then you're absorbing the picture, and then you're reading another word and absorbing the picture, and it sort of puts such a space between each word that you're kind of like, wait, no, I have to go back and like reread just the words because like I'm not really getting the meaning on a panel by panel.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good technique to use sometimes. I guess my criticism is that does that have to be the entire work?
Right.
Like there are times when we don't need the narration and then it can just be the images.
Yeah, I think like the presence of the narration added more than it detracted, but I think there it seemed to be like there was a trepidation in this era of superhero comics where like the reader's not going to get it unless it's super spelled out for them, which maybe was true. Maybe that was true at the time. I don't know, but
I think it was true for a lot of comics before this. Like there, because of the way the paneling works, there's like you have to fit such a small story into such a small space that you have to really make it tight and you have to make a big jump from panel to panel. So often the narration is to support those jumps, but the paneling is so good in here, I don't think you need that crutch.
And I think also comics literacy like is something that we discuss from time to time in the community. Comics literacy as a different type of literacy, which was being developed at the same time as these comics, I think, in the West. So I think you're right. I think we're at the stage now that comics literacy and comics writing is strong enough that this could have carried it without as much narration, but I still think the narration was interesting enough to justify itself.
Oh yeah, no, it's obviously a deliberate choice to have that much internal monologue. And I think if you didn't have any of that, then the story would be severely lacking.
Yeah, I think without this window into the psychology of both Kraven and Spider-Man, it would be a very on the nose to just kind of beat him up.
Yeah, sort of giving you this sort of backstory, this sort of context that's like oh, this is why they're reacting this way, you know? Like, it was, yeah, it was interesting that sort of it leads in with Spider-Man paying respect to like some informant, like, low-level criminal who died, and his friend Ned Leeds has just recently passed away. I won't go down that continuity rabbit hole with you all, but it's sort of like he's dealing with death. And I mean, in a lot of ways, Spider-Man's whole life has been marked by death. His uncle died and inspired him to become Spider-Man. His love, Gwen Stacy, was killed by his arch nemesis. And so he's kind of reflecting
Or
on,
by him, depending on which interpretation of that
yeah,
comic.
he accidentally. Yes, yeah, fair enough. But yeah, so he's, I mean, I'm sure he feels he's responsible. But yeah, it's just sort of like he's musing on death at the same time that now Kraven's kind of musing on getting old and like not having accomplished what he needed to accomplish, which is to get ultimate revenge on Spider-Man. And this sort of like this, I don't know, unstoppable force meets the immovable object with these two characters in that first issue where Kraven sort of throws the net on him and then pulls out the rifle, and Spider-Man's kind of like, oh, like you couldn't use a rifle, right? You'd use like a spear or a bolo or a, like we don't use rifles when we fight. And it felt a bit like, you're kind of playing, you're playing like, you're playing fight with a friend and then somebody like actually hits you. Like it's kind of like, oh wait, I thought we were just playing, but we're not playing. And it actually kind of felt like the end of an era. It was like, this is it. We're not in the 60s anymore. We're not in the 70s. Like we're in the grim dark 80s, 90s. Like, and that was sort of like the first shot heard around the world in the Marvel Universe, right? Is Spider-Man getting shot by Kraven.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was also surprised when Kraven pulled out a gun. I kind of had some of the same feelings as Spider-Man, but also I had some similar feelings against Kraven. How can I put this? I feel like Kraven was like, I have to prove myself, and I have to prove myself as the ultimate hunter, and so I'm going to use a gun. It feels like counter to his actual goals of like proving himself on his own terms. Yeah, there's always that joke of that sometimes goes around in comics of like, oh no, bullets, my only weakness.
Yeah, like I really enjoyed the especially I was, let's say the first two thirds of Kraven's arc in this. I like that he had a really strong arc that this gave him a backstory. I really like his backstory. Like it all kind of holds together really well. Like that sort of I assume he was probably Russian from the start. And then this explains, like, well, what does that actually mean? Like, for this villain character to be Russian, what kind of Russian is he? And like, how does he become this big game hunter? And like, no, it is actually just this like appropriative colonialist thing. That's who he is. Like, it all makes sense. And then this idea that like all his logic is so twisted, it all kind of like he comes up with what he wants to do based on feelings and then justifies it in his like internal monologue. Like that feels very, like very much like a person who might actually exist in the world.
Yeah, like if there was someone like Kraven, it does make sense that this is how twisted their mind would be.
Yeah.
So I did think that was, yeah, it did. Like we mentioned earlier that it was bringing a lot of depth to this otherwise cardboard cutout of a character, and I think it accomplished that.
Yeah. I think it's also kind of telling that, they kill him off at the end of this, and it's sort of like, I mean, obviously it's comics, so like now he's back and who cares, but like for like a long time I think Kraven was thought of as one of his ultimate villains. And I would say that if you were to read other earlier stories, you'd be like, oh, this guy sucks. It's just that there's Kraven's Last Hunt, and so then he's not around anymore, and so you're just like, wow, he really got Spider-Man. He was his ultimate nemesis, and you're like, yeah, in this six chapter arc he was, but like don't explore much before or after, like
It also feels like this is an era, and I haven't read a lot of early Spider-Man, where like one of the things that people really caught onto with this character is this soap opera drama where there actually were stakes and characters could die. Like we've kind of abandoned that now in superhero comics. Like even Gwen Stacy has found a way to come back.
Yes.
and Bucky, which we that was the joke throughout all the 90s. It was like, oh well, Bucky's never gonna come back.
Everyone but Bucky comes back, and then Bucky, you're like, oh, okay.
And like, I mean, I guess people like characters, and you're never gonna let the main characters die, so you gotta do something to bring out all the other ones back too. But I feel like there's a value in stories where, and I think this story kind of has the benefit of being in that world where characters can die, is that you can write a story about like the trauma of death. Like that's the main theme of this. And it doesn't, you can't write that story if you know ahead of time that, oh, they're all going to come back eventually.
Yeah, I think that's one of the big differences between manga and superhero comics is that in manga, characters usually stay dead. And it's a big deal. Like I'm reflecting on Naruto right now and like how many milestones were like major character deaths and how that's carries through like the ramifications of that carry through the characters for the whole rest of the series. They keep like thinking back to this. It's like, oh my God, because this character died, I have these like personality traits now. And it was interesting. I actually really enjoyed PTSD Peter Parker in this. It's something that I do not see often in superhero comics. I think superhero comics are so grand, right? And what they go through is actually really intense, but we don't often see this emotional ramification and fallout. At least we didn't in a lot of the comics that I've seen. I think in X-Men, we deal with it a little bit more, but it's not something that I associate with Spider-Man. To me, I wish it had gone a little farther. I could have spent more time with PTSD Peter Parker personally, but that's just my personal brain problems, I guess. I feel like I like to read about that stuff.
I have good news for you. Pick up any issue of Spider-Man written by J.M. DeMatteis, and you
Oh,
will
yeah.
have PTSD Spider-Man.
Oh, exciting. Okay. I want to see Spider-Man have a bad time.
Yeah, I think that's when Spider-Man is written well, he's gonna have a bad time.
I will note actually, there is a follow-up mini graphic novel that was released. I think it was Soul of the Hunter, or no. I can't remember the name now, but it's basically like J.M. DeMatteis and Mike Zeck got together and they did kind of a bookend where it's Spider-Man processing the trauma of everything that happened. And he, I think, gets haunted. It's not clear if it's in his head or if it's real, but he sort of gets haunted by the ghost of Kraven. And ultimately, he like helps Kraven get the piece he needs to like transition to the other side. And so it's sort of like this sort of final sort of epilogue story that I didn't want to include it in this, but just like if you are interested, there is sort of like this epilogue story of sort of how Peter kind of comes to terms with this. Though again,
Processes, you know.
every issue, every other issue of Spider-Man I read, it would be like, oh God, this reminds me of when I was buried alive by Kraven the Hunter.
Which is harsh. Like being buried alive is a really, really severe thing to go through. He was like quasi dead for 3 days. He went to some liminal afterlife and dealt with his dead friend. Like it was rough.
It's
It's
funny, no,
funny.
when that happened to Buffy the Vampire Slayer, it took a whole year for her to recover.
Well, rereading this, I had a moment where I actually realized that like when I was 7 years old, I went to the convenience store and this was sitting on the shelf and I picked it up and I specifically, it's like burned into my brain. Will constantly remember the sequence of like Ned Leeds like
Oh,
dissolving
his face
into a
melting.
decomposing corpse.
Oh my
And of course,
God.
my mom's like, put that down. Don't read that.
Comics are not for kids right now. How dare you try to pick up a comic book, child? Don't you know comics are not for kids anymore? Bang pow.
It sounds like you guys enjoyed it, which is good. I thought maybe it's worth picking at a couple, I don't know, criticisms. Because I don't know, rereading
I've
this,
got a few. Yeah.
me too.
I think definitely, well, I mean, you can tell me if this, I'm already saying one of them, but like, I think rereading it, I took note very quickly that like, whenever we need to show that the Vermin's like an evil creature that eats people, it's like he's got to like drag a woman into the shadows and conceivably kill and murder her. So it's like there's a lot of women that just get eaten to kind of like build up the badness of the vermin.
Not fun. Women in general. So like the one that really pissed me off a little bit was MJ. Like MJ is just constantly like in Peter's nightshirt. She's never just not only dressed in Peter's like oversized shirt, hanging around her apartment, being like, "Woe is me, where is my man?"
Yeah.
And then wanders around in the streets and gets almost assaulted herself. And then she's like, "I know that my spider boy will save me."
Then it's Kraven that
Oh
saves.
no, trauma. But like I don't know. I did not like MJ in this little mini arc.
I was sort of thinking like it's I was thinking it, the story's like a three-legged table with Kraven, Spider-Man, and Vermin, and then there's kind of like this fourth leg that doesn't hit the ground, which is like MJ.
Yeah, the another thing that I felt was lacking from the story was I don't think Kraven's suicide was like fully fleshed out, like what's going through his head at that moment. Like I get that that's a really interesting place for the story to go, but it just didn't like and like the first two-thirds of his arc felt very like this could be a real person, but then that last bit I just felt like there was something missing to sort of like understand how he got there.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like when I got to that page and he was, he was using a shotgun on himself, I was like, oh well, okay.
Yeah,
Guess that's that. It
I get the
felt a little abrupt. And
Yeah, there
because
needed to
it's
be more
like
build up.
I felt like Kraven kind of got everything he wanted out of this.
Yeah. And if it's the case that he got everything he wanted and realized he didn't want it after all, like we need to see that. And we didn't really get to.
So that part also did not make super, I guess it wasn't very impactful to me either, which is rough to say of something as severe as a suicide, so.
Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe I'm reading things into it, but it's like, yeah, I guess I kind of took it as like he felt like he was getting older and he wanted to sort of get his final revenge on Spider-Man, and that once he did that, he just didn't have anything else. Like he's just like, well, that's it. I'm done. And so like he just like killed himself because like he didn't see any purpose, any reason to continue past that. I don't know. I mean, I guess it's that's me reading things in and it's not in the narrative, right?
Yeah, like he didn't even wait and see. Like he didn't even wait and see how he would feel after having, quote unquote, bested Spider-Man or not. Like, I guess what is the conclusion of this? Did he best Spider-Man or did he not?
Right.
And yeah, it wasn't he had like a very like self-satisfied expression going into it, which makes it feel like he wasn't really thinking about that. Like he was still riding the high of this fight, and then he's like, yeah, now time to end it all. I feel like the buildup wasn't there for me. So like you keep saying like Kraven is like worried about himself getting older, but that's not something I see very much in this character. Like that could have been built up for me, like more of like his strength used to be greater, but now it's diminishing. Like that wasn't there for me. It just felt like unfinished business. Rather than fear of mortality. Like, I don't get a lot of fear of mortality out of this guy.
That's a good point. I didn't think of that, but no, you're right. It would have been like he tells us that, but we're being told and not shown.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know. I mean, I'm curious what you guys think of this, but just this made me think of it. It's like in the beginning, in that first issue where Kraven's like in his compound naked and he's like going up to these like stuffed animals and he's posing and then like knocking them over. Like I think maybe when I was a teenager, I originally read that as like, oh wow, he's such a badass. He's like taking out this like he'll take out this gorilla, he'll take out this panther or whatever. But like looking at it now, I was like, oh, this is like toxic masculinity. This is him just like putting on this pantomime of like I'm a big tough man, but all he's really doing is like knocking over these like stuffed animals, right? Like it
Yeah,
just sort of felt like
he really
emptiness.
is like toxic masculinity embodied in a way.
Yeah, that would have been a really good. Like, I think there's a lot of that in the story already, but I think maybe it could have been pushed even further to sort of
Yeah, I think
explore the character
if
deeper.
If someone were to write this today, that might be an angle they could go for, especially contrasting it with Peter, where you see more of this like rounded masculinity. Like he's still really powerful. He's really strong. He's capable. He's a protector, but he still like cares a lot for his friends. He cares a lot for MJ. Like a lot of what's going through his head is like wanting to get back to MJ. And there's like a real difference in the embodiment of masculinity in these two characters.
And like a lot of his trauma, like all his PTSD is about people that he's lost, which is like not like Kraven at all. Kraven is like out to cause loss.
Out to make an impact in the world in a very kind of like sharp way.
That's a good, I like that framing. So what did you guys think of the vermin?
I didn't think much about him at all.
I'll be honest. He kind of felt like a pawn, almost like a MacGuffin. You know, like he was just kind of there to be the object being acted upon. And there were some moments where we get flashes of like maybe there's more to the vermin. Like we don't, so as a reader coming in cold, isolated to the story, we don't know where this character came from. We like how long has he been in the sewers cannibalizing people? We don't know. It seems like he fought Spider-Man before and was defeated. And they made a really big deal about the fact that like Spider-Man had to team up with someone else to defeat the vermin. And it's like, okay. So okay.
I mean, I think this gets into some of the maybe existing to toxic masculinity at the time, because I remember people framing it this way that like, oh, well, Spider-Man was incapable of defeating the vermin without the help of Captain America, but then Kraven beat the vermin single-handedly. Therefore, Kraven is tougher than Spider-Man.
Oh, this is the type of conversation that used to happen in superhero circles all the time, right? Like who
It's
would
very
win?
childish.
Who would win? You know, Goku versus Superman, who would win? Like all of these debates, like
That's a really intense, important debate if you're seven.
But I do think that there was, I think that for some people, I think there is this framing that it's like, oh wow, like, you know, Kraven like cucked Spider-Man by like defeating his villain single-handedly.
I do appreciate that Spider-Man doesn't care about that framing at all, because why would he?
That's another kind of point of like the difference between these two characters. He's like, hey, it's okay to team up with your friends for the greater good. It doesn't diminish me at all that my buddy Captain America helped me take this vermin, literal vermin, off the streets.
Like, hey, Kraven, I have a friend named Captain America. Do you?
And ultimately, Peter does defeat Vermin at the end in the last chapter too. So it's like whatever one-upsmanship Kraven got, it's sort of undermined by the fact that Peter did ultimately bring the Vermin down without help, right?
He like lets him go though, doesn't he?
Well, no, he gets arrested essentially. He's gonna phone Reed Richards, Mr. Fantastic, to do something to see if he can help him medically.
Oh, right, that's right.
Which, I mean, just fun,
His other friend.
fun, yeah, another friend. Fun Thunderbolts tie-in. The Vermin was a scientist named Edward Whelan, and he was experimented on by Baron Zemo, who led the Thunderbolts. So he was a normal man who got turned into this rat human hybrid that now eats people. And then in subsequent Spectacular Spider-Man stories, DeMatteis, I think, really loves the Vermin, because Vermin shows up in a lot of Spectacular Spider-Man stories later, and he begins to transform between Edward and his rat form, and they find out that his rat form is a manifestation of childhood trauma. So hurt people, guys. Or hurt people, eat people, I guess.
People eat people. I feel like there's a little bit of allusion to that like he sees some things in his victims sometimes, or his intended victims, that draws something out of his deeper psyche, which is interesting. But yeah, in terms of his role in this story, it's like He was also there.
I did also like, though, at the end, where because the theme of this work is essentially like the sort of life and death stuff, that it doesn't even really cross Peter Parker's mind to kill the vermin. Like he's like throughout the whole thing, despite everything he's going through, he's like, obviously I'm just gonna like capture him and like hand him over to the authorities. Like that's just how this works.
Yeah.
This isn't personal.
No. Yeah, no. I mean, this is one of the things I do like about Spider-Man as a character in general is that even in the grimmest, darkest 90s, he didn't kill people. Sometimes maybe he would jump out of the way of something and it would end up, impaling his greatest foe, but like that, he never intentionally killed anybody.
And then he just feels sad for the next 20 years after that.
Yeah.
Because that's who he is.
That's good. It brings a uniqueness to his character, though. I think Peter Parker does have a very distinct personality compared to a lot of other superheroes.
Yeah, and I think that
Not that
comes.
others lack that, but I think Peter's is especially interesting in the way that it's been portrayed throughout the years.
Yeah, and I think the root of that is this sort of soap opera that was the basis of a lot of the early issues, where it's mo a lot of the story is about his interpersonal connections with other people. Sometimes they turn out to be the next supervillain, sometimes not. But yeah, I feel like that soap opera part that Stan Lee brought to the table, was really fundamental to this character and like why he's lasted so long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Final thoughts?
This book was interesting. I'm glad I read it. It's not the kind of thing I would look, seek out or read on my own if I wasn't doing it for a podcast, but I appreciated it.
Yeah, I'm Jam and I agree. And I think it is a good one to pick up if you're interested in superheroes generally, especially Spider-Man. So I feel like this is probably the first full arc of Spider-Man I've ever read. I've
Hey.
encountered Spider-Man in like other media, obviously, but also like I feel him, he pops up in other things that we read sometimes, but this is the first true Spider-Man thing that I feel like I've been able to experience, and I think it was a good representation for him.
Hey, great. I'm glad you guys enjoyed it. I definitely had moments reading this where I'm like, oh, I don't know, does this hold up? But yeah, I think there's more good than bad, I
It
think.
it's of its time. It definitely still has that superhero vibe that we talk about, and if it's not going to change your mind, I think. It's not going to change your mind on like the vibe of what superheroes comics are, but within that genre, I think it's a good example that is an enjoyable read.
Yeah, I find like I was comparing it to the Thunderbolts, which we read, and I think this works a lot better. Like there's a lot of things going on in this work that are more like the kind of comics I would seek out and enjoy.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Should we do some shout outs?
I'm JD, and I have been reading this web comic called Flowers and Ink. It's kind of a science fiction alternate universe Mesoamerica. It's not very far into the story yet, so I don't know where it's going, but it's really interesting. The art is really unique, really standout. It's by Ty Manzano, and I like it.
Oh, cool. I also have a web comic. The one I'd like to shout out is called Laika's Comet. And it's a furry web comic, but it's extremely cute and it's kind of solar punky. So it's got a post-apocalyptic but optimistic vibe. And yeah, I just find it incredibly charming. The colors are beautiful. Laika's Comet.
And I'm Jeff Ellis. I'm going to shout out the Indigenerds anthology because it just showed up in the mail for me finally. That's a new Iron Circus anthology that I'm excited to read. What are we reviewing next?
Oh, I guess next is me. We are next. We're gonna read Banned Book Club by Kim Hyun Suk, Ko Hyung Ju, and Ryan Estrada.
The Trade Waiters is presented by Cloudscape Comics. We'd like to thank Sleuth for the music. You can find us wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for listening.